Hey, it's Barry. How are you? Let me ask you this. Do you like to hear stories of murder, deceit, and unbelievable true crime? If you do, then you want Extraordinary Stories Podcast. Do you want to hear stories of incredible human survival? Stories of some of the most inspiring people who have ever lived. If you want stories of sex, death, murder, survival, and real human stories told with humour but also respect, then you want Extraordinary Stories Podcast, told by a Scottish man in a thick Scottish accent. Get it on iTunes, Spotify, anywhere that you listen to podcasts.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. In 1992, a young mother from an Atlanta suburb wanted to leave her husband. She had good reason, but she also had good reason to fear his retribution. He could take her sons away from her. Even though he never showed any interest in raising them himself, he would do it just to spite her. And he had money and legal connections to do it. So she waits. She bides her time. She hoards her pennies and hires a private detective. She snoops on her own. Finally, she has something. She's got him. If she can pull this off right, she'll be able to break free and take her sons with her. But is he on to her? Or worse, does he consider her worth more dead than alive? She doesn't live long enough to find out, because he has her brutally murdered by a close-range shotgun blast to the head in front of their two sons. Welcome to Episode 34, Murder for Hire, The Execution of Sarah Ambrusco Tokars. I didn't actually intend to cover another Thanksgiving murder this year. I had Sarah's case on the schedule before I realized the timing. She was murdered the Sunday after Thanksgiving in 1992. She pulled into the garage with her two sons asleep in the car after a 9-hour drive from Florida, where she'd been visiting her family for the holiday. As she unlocked the back door, a stranger with a sawed-off shotgun forced her back into her car. Her brutal murder, in front of her two young sons, shocked the city of Atlanta, even making national news. A beautiful young mother shot in the head in what was supposed to be a safe suburb of Atlanta. Marietta, Georgia is about a half hour northwest of Atlanta in Cobb County. A city of about 61,000, it is the largest of the Atlanta suburbs in the Atlanta metropolitan area. It was the first city to be set afire in General Sherman's March to the Sea during the Civil War, and the Marietta Confederate Cemetery holds over 3,000 graves of Confederate soldiers from the Battle of Atlanta. The city has 6 historic districts and also has the Marietta Museum of History for visitors to explore, as well as the Marietta Gone with the Wind Museum, also called Scarlet on the Square, which houses a collection of memorabilia from the book and movie. But though she lived in Marietta, Sarah's story is very much an Atlanta story. She worked as a nightclub promoter, and in the late 1980s, the nightlife scene in Atlanta was booming. Atlanta, Georgia is arguably one of the most famous U.S. southern cities in the world. It may be remembered in some places for Gone with the Wind, but modern Atlanta is known for its eclectic, diverse culture. It's often referred to as the city too busy to hate for its progressive politics compared to other large cities in the Deep South. It has long been held as a mecca for African-American political power, education, and culture. There has been a black mayor in office in Atlanta since 1974. But people who live there still deal with racial disparity and tensions. In the 1980s, when Sarah Ambrusco moved there, Atlanta was embroiled in controversial gentrification. It still is in many areas, but this was when it really got into full swing. Atlanta was also hit harder than most cities by the crack cocaine epidemic and urban decay during that time period. At 31 years old, Sarah was blonde, beautiful, and outgoing. She was a former cheerleader and very stylish, qualities that really worked in her position as marketing director for the trendy nightclub Elan. But she was also rather sheltered, despite her work in the city. It was definitely far from how she grew up. Sarah had moved to Atlanta after her marriage to an Atlanta health club owner in 1981. But before that, she had worked as an elementary school teacher in Florida. After moving to the city, she worked for a while as an aerobics instructor. The divorce was hard on Sarah. She came from a very close-knit Catholic family, the middle child of seven sisters. She actually shared a condo with one of these sisters at the time she met Fred Tokars. She and Chrissy were lookalikes, and especially close. They had been born in Amherst, New York, a suburb of Buffalo. Their father, John Ambrusco, was a doctor, and their mother, Phyllis, was a homemaker. It was an idyllic childhood, and Sarah wanted the same wholesome harmony in her life as an adult. She actually met Fred Tokars in New York when they were both just teenagers. He was from the same affluent suburb. Back in Atlanta, after her divorce, she recognized his face on the evening news. At the time, Frederick Tokars was a junior prosecutor assisting in a high-profile murder trial. Happy to see a familiar face in the big city, Sarah impulsively called him. Soon the two were dating, and a year later they were married in a civil ceremony in a judge's office. Sarah had wanted a church wedding, but she wanted a good husband even more. She was looking for a responsible, upstanding man, a man like her father who would take care of his family. She was dreaming of kids and a home in the suburbs. But the no-frills wedding was a sad indicator of what their marriage would be like. His nickname at the DA's office was Fast Fred, which Assistant District Attorney John Turner said was in reference to his ambition and constant self-promotion. Aside from his regular duties, he was also a part-time traffic court judge. But he actually didn't want to remain a prosecutor, though he harbored political ambitions. He wanted to be a tax attorney. He knew that's where the big bucks were. And he loved the Atlanta nightlife. But when he was dating Sarah, he regaled her and her sister Chrissy with all of the dramatic criminal cases he had worked, giving them a glimpse of the dangerous underworld they had grown up so far away from. He came off as such a moral and respectable man. Chrissy later said it was part of his appeal, but it was all just a snow job. He was just boasting and exaggerating to impress Sarah. He looked at her and saw an asset. She wasn't just attractive and gregarious. She ran in high social circles due to her marketing job. She rubbed elbows with the kind of businessmen he wanted to know. But it's pretty obvious he didn't care about what she really wanted or even bother really to get to know her. Because if he had, he might have realized this wasn't a great match if he was just looking for an ambitious partner rather than a wife. Sarah Ambrusco grew up in a very traditional religious family. She was over 30 years old and ready to have children of her own. Fred Tokars showed her a mirage of a man, a hero prosecuting the bad guys, a protector who would take care of her. From the very start, their marriage was strained and it was painfully obvious to her family. Her father especially didn't appreciate that Fred never had dinner at home, that he was always working late. It's ironic that a physician would feel that way. Doctors work grueling hours. How bad must it have been for him to have that opinion? He was a very hard-working man himself. He must have seen Fred Tokars more clearly than his daughter in the beginning. Regardless of the precarious start to the Tokars' marriage, Sarah was pregnant just a few months after the wedding. She was ecstatic at the birth of her first son, Ricky, in September of 1986. And her suburban dreams were coming true as well when she and Fred purchased a home in the posh Kings Cove subdivision of East Cobb, Marietta, just a hop, skip, and a jump away from the Atlanta Country Club, a place where she and Fred would surely hobnob with the upper echelon of Atlanta society. Sarah worked full-time when she was pregnant, but after Ricky was born, she wanted to stay home with him. This was her dream. She had always wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, with lots of kids and a wonderful husband to care for, just like her own mother. I realize that in 2018, some women may look down their nose at this. We are a generation that does it all. But consider the fact that we were raised by a different generation. We are latchkey kids. Our mothers worked. This wasn't Sarah's experience. And I also don't believe that she hid this from her new husband. To know Sarah was to know that she wanted a family, that she wanted a more traditional lifestyle. Fred knew this. He just didn't care. At this time, I'm going to pause to tell you about one of our sponsors. Everyone has a family member who tells the best stories, like the time you all piled into a station wagon and drove to Disney World, or how grandmother made those special tiny biscuits just for the little kids. StoryWorth helps capture these memories, preserve them forever. StoryWorth makes it easy and fun for your family to share their stories with weekly emailed story prompts, questions you might not think to ask. And at the end of the year, they will get these stories bound in a beautiful hardcover book. How it works is you purchase a subscription for someone you love, and each week, StoryWorth sends them an email with a question about their life. Then all they have to do is answer the email, or they can even record it over the phone by calling the StoryWorth number. All stories are private, shared only with family members that you chose when you purchased the subscription. And at the end of the year, all of these precious stories will be bound in a beautiful keepsake book. The weekly emails alone are a great way to stay connected with family that may be spread apart. You can learn so much about your loved ones and preserve these stories for your children and future generations. Your loved one can write those stories and also upload photos to go with them by email or on StoryWorth.com. They can save and edit everything on the website, knowing their data is secure in StoryWorth's hands. StoryWorth is a wonderful gift for the holidays, something special that cannot be bought in any store. I signed my mother up for the subscription for Christmas this year. Not just because she's my mother, but because she has the best memory for stories about my grandparents, great-grandparents, and great-aunts and uncles. For instance, she once told me about how my great-grandfather, during World War I, would write a letter a week to his sweetheart, my great-grandmother. Even if he didn't have time to write a full letter, he would just write, "Love you, sweetheart," on a scrap of paper and mail it to her. It's the little details like this that get lost over the generations. And it's the little details like this that really bring all generations of families together. I cannot wait until next year at Christmas when we can pass around this beautiful book of stories at our family celebration. And I can also purchase additional copies of the book for other family members. To start your own family's book of beloved stories, go to StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. That's right. Southern Fried listeners will get $20 off their subscription by going to StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. So what are you waiting for? Go ahead and sign up your family member for a truly unique and special gift that your whole family will treasure at StoryWorth.com/SouthernFried. And now, back to the show. Sarah's sister Chrissy later said that Fred was pissed that Sarah didn't want to work. He found it unacceptable. Sarah may have been upset by this, but she knew better than to show it. She already had one failed marriage. She wasn't looking for a second. And maybe she told herself that lie that all women in bad marriages tell themselves. He'll change. He'll come around. So she said nothing and made the best of the situation. She worked half days at the office and did the rest of her work from home, or at least she tried to. On the other hand, Atlanta's nightlife wasn't what it was when she first got into the business. There were new laws on the books, harsher sentences for DUIs, and 2-for-1 happy hours had been outlawed. Atlanta nightclubs were feeling the pinch. Business was down, the clubs lost money, and Sarah lost her job. It may have been what she wanted, but it wasn't how she wanted it. Her husband certainly wasn't happy about her employment status, but then he had just taken his own career risk. He quit the DA's office and began his own private practice. He became a criminal defense attorney. Instead of putting the bad guys away, he was now defending them. And it scared Sarah. She knew he was often paid in cash and that he defended drug dealers and other more dangerous criminals. These would be the criminals he had bragged about putting away to her and her sister when he was trying to woo Sarah. And then, of course, there was the new financial strain on the family. They had lost Sarah's income of around $40,000 a year, comparable to about $85,000 in 2018 money. And now, Fred no longer had a regular paycheck. Starting your own law practice is starting your own business. You don't get a paycheck. You gotta hustle. The first thing Fred did when Sarah lost her job was take complete control of the family finances. He put his wife on a weekly allowance for groceries, diapers, utilities, everything. And at the same time, he refused to buy new furniture or do basic home repairs. One summer, they went months without air conditioning. For Georgia summers, this is beyond cruel and unusual, especially with a baby in the house. And another baby came quickly. Mike was born just 2 years after Ricky, so Sarah was stuck at home with a newborn and a toddler with little help or money. And Fred still railed at anything she asked for. His attorney would later contend that he put his wife on a budget because she had brought debt to the relationship. I ask you, how many people don't bring debt of some sort into a marriage, especially a second marriage a bit later in life? Her sister Chrissy said Fred often ridiculed his wife, saying she didn't know the value of a dollar. Actually, as a marketing executive, I'm pretty sure she did, and she didn't need to engage in illegal behavior to make money. At this point, Sarah wasn't sure about his illegal activities. But what was she to think when he banned her from the basement, his private office, his things? He kept all files locked in a safe. It's not like he was hiding a mistress in there. Sarah wasn't stupid. Not that he was above mistresses either, but we'll get to that. Sarah started to try and scratch out some money of her own. She created Sarah and Brusco Productions, a promotions company. She even brought formal proposals to her husband, not just to ask for money, but also for his professional input, at which he usually sneered at her and certainly denied her any money. By 1992, he had her on an allowance of $400 a week. That sounds like a decent budget even now, but not when you consider he expected her to pay all of the household bills out of it, as well as buy groceries, diapers, and other necessities. So Sarah took out some credit cards in her own name, trying to bridge the gap, which only brought her more grief when she couldn't keep up with the monthly payments. And while keeping her on this tight budget, he also started complaining whenever she wanted to visit her family. If she went anyway, he wouldn't give her the money for a hotel or even gas. She had to drive the full 9 hours with small children without stopping. Trying to forbid her from seeing her family, then to show up himself, is very controlling. He was trying to isolate her, and when it didn't work, he insisted on coming. He was just too good to drive with her and the kids. His time was too important. Along with this alarming behavior, he became physically abusive to Sarah. Though he and his lawyer have vehemently denied this, an attorney Sarah consulted, as well as the private investigator she later hired, both confirmed she told them this. When Sarah gave birth to her second son, Mike, she hand-wrote out a new will. And it wasn't an impulsive or emotional decision. She had two witnesses sign it and also had it notarized. She essentially cut Fred Tokars out financially. She named her sister Therese, an attorney, as executor and trustee for her sons. She designated her younger sister Karen as the son's guardian, quote, "if my husband does not survive me." Many may shrug at this, thinking she had little property and no money. But there's no denying that she came from an affluent family and certainly stood to inherit. She may or may not have feared for her life at this point, but she damn sure didn't trust him financially, at least not when it came to her son's futures. She probably wanted to make sure they had money of their own and were never under his thumb as she was. Perhaps she was concerned for their college tuition. It really doesn't matter. Fred Tokars was doing some financial planning of his own by this time. He had taken out 3 life insurance policies on Sarah worth $1.75 million. That's $3.5 million today. And he was the primary beneficiary. His sons only inherited if he died first. About a year after Mike was born, Sarah became suspicious and then sure that Fred was having an affair. In 1989, she even sought the advice of a divorce attorney. Stephen Labovitz said Sarah was more concerned about her children than anything else. He did characterize her as fearful, both physically and emotionally, of her husband. She also hired a private detective named Ralph Perdomo to follow her husband. He later told Atlanta Magazine that Sarah had been talking about divorce with her husband for a while, and he had warned her that if she ever left, he would take the kids, and Perdomo said, quote, "he had the political contacts and the judicial contacts to do it. She was very, very intimidated by him." The political contacts he threatened were dubious at best. It was later found that Fred Tokars donated over $7,000 to the campaigns of a Superior Court Justice, the Sheriff of Fulton County, and Solicitor General. But about half of these donations were actually made in Sarah's name. But Sarah was a registered Republican and conservative. All of these candidates were Democrats. She never made these donations. The only reason I can see why he made the donations in her name is that he testified on behalf of another Fulton County sheriff charged with tax evasion and extortion. His expert testimony would be tainted by the political connections. And he was billing himself as an expert in tax laws. The year he opened his own private practice, Congress passed new money laundering laws, specifically designed to track illegal drug sales. Along with criminal defense, he started taking tax fraud cases as well as divorces and partnered with another divorce attorney. He wanted to make money fast. He earned that reputation early in his days with the DA's office. These cases were lucrative, but it was more than that. Attorney Murray Silver first met Fred when he was an assistant district attorney. After he left the DA's office, Fred and Murray shared office space for almost 3 years. Murray Silver would later testify that Fred Tokars wrote an instruction manual of sorts titled Tax Havens and Offshore Investment Opportunities. He said that the booklet detailed Fred's honed money laundering scheme. Murray also said that Fred asked him to refer some of his clients to him, explaining that he wasn't worried about the IRS. He had perfected his system and left no paper trail. Fred even bragged that he was able to hide $150,000 from one client's wife by depositing it in a bank in the Bahamas. Murray Silver also recalled that Fred Tokars taught classes on money laundering to law enforcement. The director of the Georgia Police Academy later testified, confirming that Tokars taught these classes for the state as well as the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy. Fred even wrote articles for business journals on the topic. He wrote in the Atlanta Business Chronicle, quote, "These money laundering and cash transactions requirement laws became so complex, drug dealers ultimately need to hire attorneys to explain how to circumvent the system." He said that the professional services provided to drug dealers were no different than those provided to legitimate clients, saying, quote, "In fact, attorneys often launder money without even knowing it." And he didn't just write or teach about money laundering. He was an expert because that was his practice. It became his main practice, and criminals were his clientele. A drug dealer named Marvin Baynard met with Fred in 1986 about defending a drug runner named Dexter Askew. Dexter had recently been charged with possession of cocaine that Marvin Baynard had supplied him with. Fred took the case, and he also started doing regular business with Baynard. Marvin told him he sold up to half a kilo of cocaine a week, anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000. Fred asked for a $10,000 retainer and started the process of legitimizing Marvin Baynard's business. When Marvin Baynard later testified against Fred Tokars, he said that Tokars regularly discussed offshore bank accounts and about his booklet that was an instruction manual on how to set up one of these bank accounts with $15,000. But Baynard chose not to invest, instead keeping the cash he made in his bedroom and the cocaine supply in an apartment under a different name. He said Fred Tokars advised him of this setup. Another drug dealer named Mark McDougall later testified against Fred Tokars and said that he and a man named Zane Carroll had worked with Tokars to invest in a new nightclub called Parrot. McDougall and Carroll would own 51% of the club, while another partner named Billy Carter would obtain the liquor license due to McDougall's felony record. Fred Tokars also incorporated the Parrot Acquisition Corporation, of which he was listed as general counsel and a partner. His other partners were James Mason and Billy Carter. Carter was a former GBI agent who was fired after being convicted of simple battery in Savannah. Mason was a nightclub entrepreneur and a high-profile businessman who associated with local celebrities, politicians, and judges. Known as the godfather of Atlanta's black nightclub scene, he was also part owner in these clubs as well as owner of The Warehouse, Dominique's, Diamonds and Pearls, and Park Place Salon. Fred Tokars helped him make the deal to acquire Diamonds and Pearls, originally a nightclub located in Detroit. Billy Carter and James Mason were really frontmen for two drug dealers from Detroit named Jesse Ferguson and Julius Klein. They both started investing in Atlanta nightclubs shortly after moving there in 1985. I talked in the beginning about the drug epidemic plaguing Atlanta during this time, and I also talked about the decline in the nightclub life. Drug dealers saw an opening here and swooped in. These guys sold about 20 kilos of cocaine a week. Nightclubs were the perfect front. Klein was actually a partner with James Mason in a company called Zebra Inc., which operated the club Dominique's and then later Trax. When James Mason passed away in 2015, a Rolling Stone article claimed his reputation was tarnished by his association with Fred Tokars. Really? Because being the front man for drug dealers wasn't bad enough, James Mason also settled a lawsuit with a woman named Linda Campbell, who had worked at Park Place Salon. She claimed he assaulted her. Fred Tokars represented Mason and negotiated a settlement of $17,500. He also suggested that Mason use his shares of stock in the Parrot as collateral. When Mason defaulted on his payments to Ms. Campbell, she hired a new attorney who demanded the stock be put in Campbell's name. At this, Fred claimed he was no longer a part of the Parrot Corporation, spurring a new lawsuit filed against all officers and shareholders, including himself, James Mason, Julius Klein, Billy Carter, and another drug dealer named Al Brown. In 1990, Zebra Inc. was evicted from Dominique's for non-payment of rent. Losing this location in front was bad for business, so James Mason approached an agent named Douglas McKendrick, saying he had an endorsement contract with Deion Sanders. Deion Sanders was a football and baseball player for the Atlanta Falcons and Atlanta Braves. He spent 14 years in the NFL and is the only man to have played in both the Super Bowl and the World Series. In September of 1990, Fred Tokars incorporated Atlanta Entertainment Management with Mason and Klein as partners to keep the deal with Deion Sanders. He helped finalize the deal with Sanders, and Deion's Club 21 was opened. I could literally ramble on for a couple of hours about all of the twisting connections Fred Tokars had to illegal drugs, mobsters, and money laundering. I took you this far to explain a really important connection. In the spring of 1992, Fred Tokars introduced a man named Eddie Lawrence to James Mason at Diamonds and Pearls nightclub. He also introduced him to Julius Klein and several other drug dealers he did business with. On August 5th, 1992, a car carrying 115 kilos of cocaine was stopped in Amarillo, Texas. The DEA had the car airlifted to Atlanta when the driver agreed to cooperate. The driver delivered the cocaine to Al Brown, one of the main dealers in Atlanta I mentioned earlier. When DEA agents searched Brown's car, they found documents tying him to several businesses, including the club Diamonds and Pearls. Fred represented Al Brown at a detention hearing where he was informed that since he had incorporated Diamonds and Pearls, he could be called as a witness. James Mason tried to claim 100% ownership in Diamonds and Pearls, saying Al Brown was merely a doorman. At this, he was subpoenaed to produce all records of the club, and then Fred Tokars referred him to another attorney. This was the beginning of the end, and by August of 1992, his wife was on to him. Sarah finally had the proof she needed to break free of Fred Tokars, but he would never let her do that. And now I'm going to pause for a final word from one of our sponsors. Vitamins are essential to a healthy lifestyle, but perhaps never more so than when we are in the middle of cold and flu season. Care of can make taking care of yourself this winter so easy with personalized vitamin and supplement packets perfect for on the go. Care of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers a box of your personalized vitamins and supplements in daily dosage packets delivered right to your door. Support your body with an extra healthy boost of vitamins to help you stay in shape for next summer. And give yourself a boost this hectic holiday season by adding supplements to help you sleep and raise your energy levels. You just go to takecareof.com and the quiz only takes 5 minutes. It will ask you about your diet and health goals to find out exactly which vitamins and supplements are best suited to your needs. 90% of people fall short of the FDA's recommended guidelines for at least one vitamin or nutrient, no matter how careful we are about our choices. Care of's online quiz takes the guesswork out of choosing the right vitamins. I was pleasantly surprised at how easy the quiz was, and at the same time, it asked me questions I never would have thought of. I got personal recommendations that made so much more sense to me than when I have Googled vitamin questions. And your monthly subscription box can be easily modified at any time. This month, I added Care of's delicious, nutrient-packed quick stick powders. They simply melt in your mouth and are a fantastic supplement, whether you are trying to chill out, power up, or catch some Z's. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter promo code Southern Fried. That's takecareof.com, and the promo code for Southern Fried listeners is Southern Fried. Once again, go to takecareof.com and enter code Southern Fried to get 25% off your first personalized order. You won't regret it. And now, back to the show. I told you earlier that Sarah Tokars had hired a private detective named Ralph Perdomo. He did prove that Fred Tokars was having an affair. Fred later confirmed it was true during the media frenzy that followed his wife's murder. But he insisted they were working through it, and he had agreed to marriage counseling. They weren't working through anything. Sarah was even more incensed about her husband. She broke the cardinal rule and went snooping in his basement and figured out the combination of his locked safe. Once she saw what was in there, she called Ralph Perdomo back over. She took him downstairs and showed him the safe. He later testified that he saw documents, several money bags, and what looked like prescription medication. Sarah asked him to take the documents, make copies, and find out exactly what they were. But Perdomo refused. He told her he couldn't. It would be breaking the law. He told her to make copies herself to hold on to for security, and then suggested her family doctor could figure out what the medication was. He bluntly told her he wouldn't be able to help her. Then Sarah Tokars begged him to turn over his investigation to the police if anything ever happened to her. Ralph Perdomo later expressed deep regret over his falling out with Sarah. He wished he had helped her. At the time, he wrote her off as another angry, cheated-on housewife and thought she was just being dramatic. He misjudged Sarah Tokars. She wasn't just any suburban housewife. She had lived and worked the nightclub life, and she was no fool. And now she had an idea of what her husband was up to. What she didn't know was that he was already on law enforcement's radar, both locally and federally. But Fred did know this, and he would also have known if Sarah filed for divorce, an alimony and custody fight would require him to disclose his assets. The walls were closing in on him. He resigned his corporate position with Parrot Acquisitions and several other companies. He was distancing himself from the men he had been hired to cover up for. But if his wife went rogue and filed for divorce before he could completely extricate himself, he was done for. What he didn't know was that Sarah had changed her mind about the divorce, resigning herself to a life of unhappiness, accepting this as her lot in life as long as her boys were happy. Her own attorney told her he couldn't promise her full custody no matter what she had found on Fred Tokars. If only her lawyer and the PI had believed Sarah. If only they knew that federal agents were closing in on Fred. They probably would have advised her to leave immediately, to file an emergency petition for custody and expose what she knew about her husband. It's possible both men just believed that Fred Tokars was a white-collar criminal with no real motive for hurting Sarah. It seems naive to us now, but it is possible. But by August of 1992, Fred Tokars had already decided Sarah was a problem that had to be taken care of. He asked Eddie Lawrence, a drug dealer and counterfeiter, if he would kill somebody for him. He said his wife was planning on divorcing him and would take everything. According to court documents, Eddie Lawrence supposedly replied, "Let her have it," telling Fred that he could always make that money back. But according to Lawrence, Fred said, quote, that he worked too hard and all she ever did was spend his money and he wasn't going to give it to her. He would kill her first. When Eddie asked Fred about his children, Fred said they would be fine. They were young and they would get over it. Fred Tokars offered Eddie Lawrence $25,000 plus a portion of Sarah's life insurance proceeds to kill her. He even threatened to destroy Lawrence's business if he didn't help him. He finally told him he didn't care if Eddie didn't do it himself. He just wanted it done. Eddie Lawrence relented. He called up a local crack addict he knew named Curtis Rauer and offered him $5,000 to commit the murder. Curtis Rauer accepted. The week before Thanksgiving, Lawrence and Rauer broke into the Tokars' home. It was in the early morning hours before dawn, and Fred had either never made it home that night or was already gone for the day. Rauer later testified that Eddie Lawrence already knew that Sarah would be sleeping in the room with her boys. He also knew that the sliding glass door would be unlocked, and the alarm was disabled. The lock on the door was actually broken, but Fred wouldn't pay to get it fixed. So he was definitely aware of the open door. But as soon as Lawrence and Rauer entered the house, Jake, Ricky's dog, started barking. A light came on, and the men fled. On the Monday before Thanksgiving of 1992, Fred called Eddie Lawrence and told him that Sarah was going to be visiting her family in Florida all week, and he wanted her killed as soon as she got back. He specifically said he wanted her shot in the head, so there was no chance of her surviving. Fred was scheduled to meet with an inmate in Alabama that he was representing and therefore would have a solid alibi. Fred and Sarah did their usual routine. She drove to Florida with the children as Fred flew in. He flew back that Saturday and had a meeting with Eddie Lawrence. They met at his law office that night, and he told him Sarah was driving back from Florida and would be back Sunday evening around 8 or 9 p.m. Meanwhile, Sarah and her boys were saying goodbye to her family. Her father later said that usually they would all cry when they had to leave, but this time, Sarah and the boys were singing, "I'll Be Home for Christmas." Fred drove to Montgomery the next morning and checked into a hotel and then called his answering service to leave a number he could be reached at in case of an emergency, setting up his alibi. He then called John Ambrusco and asked if Sarah and the boys were on the road yet. Her father said yes, and Fred was able to confirm the time she would be home with Eddie Lawrence. Sarah may have accepted that her marriage with Fred Tokars would continue, but she was making strides to see more of her family and get more of her independence back. Her family said she was talking about getting a part-time job for her own money and was planning more and longer trips home. Whether or not Fred Tokars knew of Sarah's decision to stay, it didn't matter. Even if he did know, he was a shrewd enough lawyer to know that if he was prosecuted for his shady dealings, Sarah would probably be subpoenaed. The deal with Eddie Lawrence was done. Sarah only had a matter of hours to live. At 7 o'clock that Sunday night, after Thanksgiving, Eddie Lawrence picked up Curtis Rauer and gave him a sawed-off shotgun. He then dropped him off at the Tokars' home and told him to wait in the house and kill Sarah when she came in the back door. He then drove to a nearby neighborhood and waited. It was a little after 10 o'clock when Sarah pulled into the garage. Mike, her youngest son, was asleep in the back seat. She, Ricky, and Jake got out of the car and went to the back door. When Sarah opened the door, she was confronted by Curtis Rauer. Jake immediately began barking, so Curtis kicked him and then forced Sarah and Ricky back into the car. Sarah got in the driver's seat and Ricky in the front seat as Curtis got in the back next to Mike, holding the sawed-off shotgun to Sarah's head. He screamed at her, telling her to drive. He later told police that she begged him, "Please just don't hurt me and my kids." He also later said the reason he didn't kill her right away as instructed is because he hadn't yet been paid the $5,000 he was promised by Eddie Lawrence. And now Lawrence had left. He thought he had ditched him to kill Sarah on his own, which he had. Curtis Rauer was agitated. He was addicted to crack and nervous. He screamed obscenities at Sarah as he ordered her to drive him to a housing project in Atlanta. She drove the direction she was ordered, but about a half mile from the house, Curtis Rauer told her to turn down a dark street. Instead, Sarah pulled off to the side of the road. Mike had woken up and, according to Rauer, was pulling at his arm. He also later said that Eddie Lawrence had told him, "Don't touch the kids, don't do nothing to the kids." Sarah tried to give Rauer her purse and begged him to just leave them alone. She said, "Take the car. Just don't hurt me or my children." Rauer said at this point he had spotted Lawrence parked on a side street, and within moments, Eddie Lawrence was at Sarah's car door. Curtis Rauer said she acted shocked and as if she knew Eddie. Sarah probably did recognize Eddie Lawrence, a frequent associate of her husband. Because in a last heroic move, she shoved little Ricky's head into the floorboard and suddenly hit the gas, knocking Eddie Lawrence down, right as Curtis Rauer pulled the trigger. Sarah died instantly and slumped over the driver's wheel as the car kept rolling across the road, coming to a stop in a field. Curtis Rauer jumped out and ran. Ricky Tokars reached across his mother's body and turned the engine off. He then pulled Mike out of the back seat and ran for the nearest house with lights. When a man answered the door, he saw two small boys, covered in blood, crying hysterically. Ricky asked him to please call his grandfather because he was a doctor who could help his mommy. He cried, "A bad man shot my mom, a bad black man with a pirate gun." The homeowner ran to Sarah's car and opened the door. Her head was almost completely blown apart. Cobb County Sheriff's deputies were horrified not just at the murder scene, but by the blood-splattered and traumatized little boys. Police quickly found Fred Tokars in Montgomery and informed him of his wife's death. He reportedly was hysterical. John Ambrusco said he was hysterical when he talked to him. Naturally, the Ambruscos were devastated. They may not have really liked their son-in-law, but they did not immediately suspect him. In fact, he spent that Christmas with them. By then, Eddie Lawrence had been arrested. His association with Fred wasn't made public yet, and the arrest was for bad checks. But within a week of his arrest, the boyfriend of Curtis Rauer's sister went to the police. He said that Eddie Lawrence had offered him $5,000 for a hit, and he turned him down. But he said he was pretty sure his girlfriend's brother had taken the deal. Curtis Rauer was pulled out from under a bed in his cousin's home, where he was hiding just 2 days before Christmas. Less than a day later, he had confessed to Sarah's murder, though he said he hadn't meant to kill her. He claimed Eddie hit his arm and the gun went off. A detective called Fred Tokars at Sarah's parents' house and told him of the arrest. John Ambrusco said that he had no reaction to the news. He asked Fred to tell them about Eddie Lawrence, but Fred insisted he didn't believe Eddie was involved. Sarah's brother-in-law later said that Fred kept saying he was worried that the police were making a deal. A deal with Lawrence and Rauer to testify against him. I'm honestly not sure how the family handled this behavior. Fred was characterized as hysterical and paranoid, so maybe they wrote it off. Because on Christmas Eve, when Fred didn't show up to go to Busch Gardens with the rest of the family, Dr. Ambrusco went to his hotel room. He found him unconscious. Fred had taken a bunch of pills and left a suicide note. He opened the note with an apology, quote, "I am sorry for the pain and sorrow my lifestyle has inflicted upon you. I never wanted Sarah or anybody to get hurt." He ended the long note by blaming the media coverage, saying, "The press has made me feel like a suspect. I shouldn't be. The torture has weakened me to the point where I can't take it anymore. I want to die." I don't ever like to judge a situation like this. Some might say he never meant to die, that he knew the family was expecting him and someone would come and find him. Others would point out that the two men he hired had been caught and confessed. The jig was up, and he knew it. He didn't want to go to prison. But I choose to focus on the language. He uses the word lifestyle. He'll use that word again on New Year's Eve to the media, and it quickly turned the public against him. As he begged the press to leave him alone, he said that his wife's murder had cost him his whole lifestyle. Yes, it was a very poor choice of words. But it is actually the correct choice. Sarah was a lifestyle for him, a beautiful blonde with charm and business contacts. When she didn't want that life anymore, he didn't want her, but he was unwilling to lose her publicly. He had always wanted her for what she represented, not for who she really was. And when she became a threat to his lifestyle, he had her killed. In 1994, Fred Tokars was convicted of racketeering, money laundering, and drug conspiracy-related charges in a federal court. He got 4 life sentences in federal prison. He then went to trial on capital murder charges in January of 1997. Lawrence and Rauer both took plea deals. Lawrence was put into witness protection and was the star witness at Fred Tokars' murder trial. The murder trial itself has been criticized by some. Fred Tokars was already serving life sentences. Many websites say that Cobb County District Attorney Tom Sharon was a zealous proponent of the death penalty and took this case to trial, hoping to convict Tokars and send him to the electric chair. On Saturday, March 8, 1997, the jury found Fred Tokars guilty of Sarah's murder. 4 days later, they found that the state had proven beyond a reasonable doubt the aggravating circumstances permitting a death sentence. But they still decided to only impose a life sentence on Tokars. I saw one article complaining that the DA, quote, wasted $1 million of taxpayers' money to try Fred Tokars for the murder of his wife. And I say to that, so what? Yes, he was convicted on federal charges. Not only are there chances for appeals, that is not holding him accountable for the death of his wife. Her children and family deserve their day in court. And so did the city of Atlanta. The murder of a beautiful white woman by two black men dominated the news. Some wanted to write it off as yet another senseless murder due to drugs. But no one can deny that it stirred racial tensions. I think it was extremely important to put Fred Tokars on trial, not only for justice for Sarah, but to prove to the public that he was the mastermind. That he, a respected, white, rich man in Atlanta, had his wife shot down in front of his own children. The trial was televised on Court TV. It was a national sensation. 26 years later, people are not still talking about two black men murdering a white woman. They talk about a husband so selfish, he was willing to traumatize his own children to silence his wife and save his own hide. Because in the end, Sarah did get him. Those papers she copied proved he had offshore shell accounts in the Bahamas. They showed criminal conspiracy. Had she used those papers, she would have won. But she worried more about her children. She was willing to sacrifice her own happiness to make sure she could stay with them. In the past 26 years, Fred Tokars has made himself useful in federal prison. He is in witness protection, and he has been instrumental in solving 6 murder cases, all by befriending murderers, exacting a confession, sometimes under the guise of helping them out as a jailhouse lawyer. One even included a death row conviction. Tokars has reportedly done this so that one day his sons would learn he was capable of good. One prosecutor said that, quote, Fred did this to leave a good legacy for his children. What legacy? I'm glad he helped put other murderers away, don't get me wrong. But I'm certain Sarah Tokars would have wanted quite a different legacy for her children. And Fred Tokars has also claimed that he has written several times to his grown sons. His sons and their grandparents denied receiving any letters. Rick Tokars, who bravely shut off the engine and pulled his little brother from the car that awful night, is now living in California. He's an avid traveler and a surfer. Mike Tokars is a journalist living in New York. He has contributed to many major publications, including the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In a piece he wrote for the AJC in 2012, he credits his mother's 6 sisters and his maternal grandfather for raising him and his brother, and for helping them to remember and honor their beloved mother. About his loving family, Mike said, quote, I have observed the spirit does not come from an individual source, but from all of their efforts combined. It feels safe and warm, like Mass on Christmas morning. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly from Spreaker, my network online, or on their app. And I'm also on Stitcher, CastBox, and many other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you can visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open. Just go to whatamaneuver.net and click on Shop by Store, then search for Southern Fried True Crime. I have all sorts of t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the Sarah Tokars case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my main Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.